misinterpretation. The fact that they were naked. It says openly in the Chumash that the both of them were naked. This has to grab your attention. They were both naked, the man and his wife, and they were not ashamed. So this is very difficult. Right away it tells you that there was something different about them. They were in a different kind of a state, because this is not something that we can relate to. I mean, ordinarily people are ashamed. I'm sure there's nudist colonies, but that means that these people have overcome their shame, for whatever reason, but that's a natural phenomenon. And then as a result of the fact that they sinned, they were punished, they were driven out of the garden. And interestingly enough, as an automatic result of that, as soon as they sinned, then they began to feel shame. And they tried to hide from God. And they tried to cover themselves. So there are many questions over here. I want to address what I consider to be the fundamental questions. Basically, what was the nature of Adam prior to the sin? Because that's the way God intended him to be. That's the way he was created by God. And what, as a result of the sin, we would like to understand what the sin is. He underwent a fundamental kind of a change. And exists. So what does that mean? What's the significance? What's the implication?
Yes, come on.
Innocent? Well, in what sense was he innocent? Yeah, innocent. That's the way most of it appears to be that way. But not that innocent that he didn't sin. Right? And how was he changed as a result of it? And why would one sin change the entire picture? There was something unique about this sin. Something very unusual about this sin. That's different from any other sin. Okay, well, people are coming? All right, maybe we're just going to have to bear with each other for a while until... we'll just pause for a second. Let me continue. I mentioned this on Shabbos. I mentioned on Shabbos that there are two accounts of creation. Is this on? We went over this on Shabbos in the afternoon, that the Torah, after describing the first account of creation, it returns to what is known as the I got musical accompaniment tonight. Very good. Just, you know, it's an artistic presentation. Very good, very good. I like that. All right, just again, to recap, the Torah has two accounts of creation. In the first account, it simply tells you the results, what was created on day one, day two, day three. Then it returns to the subject again, and it provides more information. It was this Shabbos we took up the story of the special creation of woman. That in the first account, God simply says that God created man and woman. It would appear simultaneously. But we learn in the second account that it's not the case. And we analyze that this Shabbos. But there are many other things that are contained in the second account. The purpose of the second account is to provide further information. Not just the results of creation, but the underlying reasons and the factors that went into it. Now, interestingly enough, the story of the sin, the first sin, takes place in the account of creation. Now, that itself raises a very important question. Because why is this sin different than any other sin? Much of the story of Bereishis has to do with people sinning. Pretty soon we're going to read about Cain and Abel, their sin. That's not part of the story of creation. That's part of history. So you should distinguish between God creates the world, sets it up, and then the history of mankind, which is very replete with sinning, obviously. But this sin is not part of the history. This sin occurs as part of the account of creation. So the real question is, why is the story of the first sin incorporated into the story of creation? What does it have to do with creation? That's a very significant point that we have to be cognizant of. Now, if you look at the story carefully, the names of God in the first account as opposed to the names of God in the second account, is very significant. In the first account, the name that is used is Elohim, only Elohim. And God saw Elohim. Now, the name of Elohim always refers to God in the attribute of justice, of justice. In the second account, it's Adoshem Elohim. I can't say the name because you're not supposed to say the name in vain. Adoshem Elohim. Now, the name Adoshem refers to God in the attribute of mercy. Of mercy. So, that's another thing that we have to take into account. Why? The first account is justice, and the second account is mercy. If anything, the second account seems to be justice, because in the second account they're sinning and they're being punished and they're being driven out of the Garden of Eden. And yet, the name of God in that context is God as he manifests himself in terms of mercy. So, that's another issue. Of course, as I mentioned at the beginning, the whole issue of nakedness has to be addressed. Why is it that they were naked and didn't feel shame? How do we understand such a thing? And if that was the case, if that were the way mankind was intended to be, just like all the other animals, no, there's no other animal that experiences shame, so you could say that there's no reason to feel shame, rationally. But then why, as a result of sin, did they suddenly feel shame? The sin that they committed does not seem to have anything to do with the factor of nakedness. It wasn't a sexual sin, at least from all intents and purposes. They were commanded not to eat from the fruit of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. And they violated that command, and they ate. So what's the connection causally between that and the emergence of this feeling of shame? And of course we have to try and understand what's this whole idea of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. What is the significance of that? What does it mean, the knowledge of good and evil? Does that mean that as they were created, they did not have knowledge of good and evil? And as a result of the sin, they somehow obtained a knowledge of good and evil? That would be the implication. So what I want to point out to you is that on the surface it may seem like some kind of a fable or a story or a myth, however people want to characterize it, but that is not correct. There's no such thing in the Torah. Everything in the Torah, when it's analyzed, contains profound knowledge, profound depth, tremendous insight into the human personality, the human makeup, which is of eternal relevance to us. And that's what I'm going to try and elucidate in this year tonight. And of course we have to understand the reason why they were banished from the Garden of Eden. Again, if that's where they were intended to live, just because they committed the sin, so why did they have to be banished? So that's what we're going to address. Well, what's going on over here? Now, the vehicle for an attempt to understand what's really going on, in my opinion, I have not seen anything except, you know, the interpretation of Maimonides in The Guide for the Perplexed at the opening of the book. And he breaks it open. But the guide is very complicated reading. It's not that simple to read. It's a book you have to study. I've been carrying around for about 30 years. It's something you got to study, and, you know, I used to highlight. Now everything is highlighted. The only, I don't highlight if I want to, because it's the kind of, it warrants reading and rereading and study. And there's many sections that are still incomprehensible. I mean, to me, it depends on the person. But he provides us with an interpretation. So please bear with me. The material here is not that easy, but I think it's rewarding if we pay attention. Now, in the midst of it, of this first chapter, he raises a question. Somebody asked him a question, and he quotes the question. It would at first sight, said the questioner, appear from Scripture that man was originally intended to be perfectly equal to the rest of the animal creation, which is not endowed with intellect, reason, or power of distinguishing between good and evil. But that Adam's disobedience to the command of God procured him that great perfection, which is the peculiarity of man, namely the power of distinguishing between good and evil, the noblest of all the faculties of our nature, the essential characteristic of the human race. It thus appears strange that the punishment for rebelliousness should be the means of elevating man to a pinnacle of perfection to which he had not attained previously. This is equivalent to saying that a certain man was rebellious and extremely wicked, wherefore his nature was changed for the better, and he was made to shine as a star in the heavens. Such was the purport and subject of the question, though not in the exact words of the inquirer. So just to recapitulate the question, he's saying it would appear that as a result of the sin, he now obtains a knowledge of good and evil. And if you want to say that before him he wasn't ashamed, he went around naked like an animal, now he dresses like a human being, that's not included in the question. But the basic question is that that seems to be the uniqueness of man, that man is the only being in the universe that is capable of discerning between good and evil. And that ability comes to him as a result of the fact that he sinned. So instead of a punishment for the sin, which is the way you would think it would be, it seems that he's being rewarded and he's being elevated above the animals. That was the question that was presented to the Rambam. Now, the Rambam proceeds to answer the question. It's interesting how he, just to quote something in passing, because he starts off by saying, some years ago, a learned man asked me a question of great importance. He refers to this person as a learned man. But in the introduction to the answer, he rebukes the person. He rebukes him. It's interesting just to, in passing, to take note of the rebuke. He says, this is the Rambam, Mark, notice our reply, which was as follows, quote, you appear to have studied the matter superficially, and nevertheless you imagine that you can understand a book which has been the guide of past and present generations, when you for a moment withdraw from your lusts and appetites and glance over its contents as if you were reading a historical work or some poetical composition. Collect your thoughts and examine the matter carefully, for it is not to be understood as you at first sight think, but as you will find after due deliberation. So he's really rebuking him. He calls him a learned man, which means to say that this person was an intelligent individual. But the rebuke was his whole approach to Torah. He was reading the Torah superficially, and he was trying to understand things at face value instead of really probing into it. And basically, he was accusing him of being lazy. And you're intelligent, you're sort of a hedonist. And so when it suits you, you want to read the Torah, but you imagine that just your superficial understanding is sufficient to really render you into a critic of Torah. So it's interesting to take note of that. Now I just want to present, I'm not going to read the entire answer, I'm going to read parts of it, but I'm going to set it up. The Rambam says that his idea that man was lacking in knowledge before the sin is completely false. Because it seems, what he seems to be saying is that the intellect, namely the intellect which was granted to man as the highest endowment, was bestowed on him before his disobedience. That is to say that before the sin, it's clear from the story itself that Adam possessed intelligence and reason. And what are the proofs? What are the proofs of that? The naming of the animals. There are three, I would say there are three solid proofs. The Rambam cites two of them. It's very clear that his rational faculty was complete, was fully operative before the sin. One is the fact, you see, that he's engaging in the naming of the animals, which we mentioned on Shabbos, that really was a study. He was studying the animal kingdom. The idea of the naming, by the way, is really definition. When he defines classification, it was a highly sophisticated scientific activity. He was classifying, and on the basis of his understanding of the animal kingdom to divide them into species and genera and so forth. Also, the fact is that it says clearly that God created him, the Tzelem Elokim, in the image of God. Now, the image of God, of course, is not referring to the physical form of man. That's a reference to the intellectual component, to the soul, the divine soul, which has the capacity for knowledge and understanding. There's one further proof, though, that he mentions, if you could think of it. One further proof that makes it clear that he definitely had understanding.
This is an intention. I mean, he's trying to do something, and he's expected to understand it. An animal wouldn't understand
it. Exactly. That's the one that the Rambam cites. that the fact is that he is the only creature that God communicated with, and he was given commandments to observe. And commandments cannot be given to, as he says, the brute creation. Animals can't be commanded because they don't have the intelligence, they don't have the understanding whereby they can control their instincts. So if that's the case, it's clear that prior to the sin, Adam was in possession of a fully developed rational faculty. So if that's the case, how would you define man prior to the sin? What would be the definition? What were the components? What were the components? Yes? He's higher, but what? But let's define what he is. Sure, he's higher, but how would you define him? How would you categorize him? What would be the the identity, the definition of this being? He can think, but there's more. He's not just a thinking being. He's also an instinctual being. It says that the man was an nefesh chaya, was an instinctual being. So he had animalistic instincts. He did have an animalistic side, but he also had a rational side. So I think if you've ever studied Aristotle, the Aristotelian definition of man as a rational animal. He is, well, different than the animals had only a single element to their personality, the instinctual. Man had an instinctual side, but in addition to this, this is what makes man so unique, in that he is an animal on the one hand, but on the other hand, he possesses a different faculty, the capacity for reason and understanding. So that's, I think it's fair to say, a rational animal. Okay, now can anybody explain to me, if that's the case, so why didn't he feel shame? Why didn't he feel shame? He walked around, they were both naked, and they did not feel any shame. Torah makes a big point out of that. Well, if you know, all you need to do is just follow the logic. Where does shame come from? From evil? No. Evil may be... No. Well, first of all, there's a lot of evil people out there that don't feel ashamed. So, it doesn't necessarily. But I mean, what is it in man that causes man to feel shame? Now, I've said that man... Well, the knowledge... The instinct, for example, does shame stem from the instinct? A person has appetite. So the appetite doesn't bring about shame. Well, education... shame doesn't stem from knowledge either. Shame doesn't stem from knowledge. That's not the component of the mind that produces shame. Your shame is emotion. Well, yeah, that's true. That's true that it's brought about.
That something is wrong or shameful, it has to be defined that way. Otherwise, objectively, why would something evoke shame? Objectively, there's no rational...
Well, the children don't have shame. Children, until they reach a certain age, they go around naked and they don't feel any shame. Yeah, but then you see, suddenly at a certain point in time, they automatically feel shame, and it's not that all of a sudden they've been told. It doesn't work that simply, I don't think.
An awareness,
yeah. It's
something to consider.
Well, shame stems from a certain component of the psyche. And to study psychology, the breakdown, the psychological breakdown, the terminology would be instinctual, which is called the id. Then you have the ego, which is the conscious part of man, the thinking part of man. Now, the thinking part of man just produces ideas. The mind does not produce emotions. The mind produces knowledge. Now, whether that knowledge will produce a certain emotion or not, that depends upon another faculty. And the faculty we're talking about is what psychologists refer to as the superego, or what we may refer to as conscience. That's a faculty in man. If you remove the conscience from a person, they will not feel shame. And they may know that something is wrong, but they won't feel any shame about it. There are psychopathic personalities that don't feel guilt. All of the emotions that we're talking about, the emotions of shame, the emotions of guilt, the emotions of depression, they only stem from the fact that there's another part of man, which is, call it conscience, as I'm using a psychological term, superego. I'm sure you're all familiar with that. That's another faculty in man, which is to say that man has a certain image, a certain ego ideal that he lives up to in his mind. That depends what your ego ideal is. And you feel what makes it there. You're right, convention. You see, if different societies will have different ideals. So that in one society, an Islamic society, giving up your life to destroy Jews, that's great. That makes you feel that you fulfilled your ego ideal. And to the contrary, if you refrain from doing it, then you're going to feel guilty because you didn't live up to the ego ideal. That is a separate component of the psyche. If it's, that's why children don't feel any shame, because the superego has not yet reached the stage of development. They may feel fear because the parent is going to punish them. By the way, you can see it also under the influence of certain drugs or alcohol. The person drinks. The reason why, by the way, give away some secrets here. The reason why people feel, you know, loosen up or they do crazy things under the influence is because alcohol has the effect of diminishing the superego. That's why people drink, because they feel relaxed and they don't feel the same shame. When a person gets really drunk, he carries on and does things that would horrify him in his natural state, because the faculty is wiped out. It's not the mind so much, it affects the mind as well. But the person knows what's right and what's wrong, but he doesn't have the same feeling about it. So that's a crucial part of the story. It would therefore seem, and this is a very strange, it's going to sound very, very strange, and that is that if Adam did not feel any shame prior to the sin, then you have to conclude that he was missing a certain faculty. That's why I made a point of saying he was a rational animal. He had the faculty of rationality, and as I said, the mind produces knowledge, it produces ideas, it doesn't produce any feelings. How those ideas impact on your personality, that's feeling, but the mind is not the source of shame. And certainly the instincts are simply desiring gratification. So the instincts are not the source of shame. Now the source of shame is because there's another faculty which, as we're saying, ego, ideal, superego produces conscience. And if you can create, you can construct the being which has instinct, which has knowledge, and which does not have a superego, then it will not have the capacity to feel shame. It will not have the capacity to feel shame. So you must come to a startling conclusion that man in the pristine state, and the way God had intended him to be, was not supposed to have a conscience. Was not supposed to have a conscience. Now, if that is the case, of course, you know, the question arises, first of all, so why did God give him a conscience later on? What about the necessity for a conscience? I mean, as you can see, as soon as they sinned, they felt shame. And they felt shame about the fact they were naked. And the sin did not have anything to do with the fact of sex, at least on the surface. It didn't have anything to do with the fact they were naked. And it's not even something they thought about for a second. It was instantaneous. That's what if you read the Chumash, that's what it says, that as soon as they sinned, they immediately realized that they were naked. So makes a big point out of that. Their eyes were open. And she gave also to her husband with her, and he ate. That's now verse 7. Then the eyes of both of them were opened, and they realized that they were naked. So as soon as they ate, they didn't even think about it. It wasn't a matter of thinking about anything. It wasn't a matter of realizing, oh my gosh, we were disobedient. But instantaneously, they felt shame. Which means that God had implanted in them at that point this new faculty, and this new faculty automatically produces a sense of shame. This seems to be a universal phenomenon, that any being, any creature with a superego will feel shame about the fact of nudity. The sexual shame seems to be inherently connected to the institution of superego. But of course we have to understand it. If it's God's will that man should not have this faculty, that man is complete without the superego. And how is that possible? We, in our understanding of things, the conscience seems to be the most important element of man. And we speak about a person having a conscience or follow your conscience. Some people say, let conscience be your guide. And that those people who are evil, we say they don't have a conscience. So how can you conceive of man in the state of perfection without a conscience. So that's what I'm going to try and explain to tonight. Now, again, I'm going to read to you from the guide, and I'm going to ask you again to bear with me because it's not that easy, and I'm going to try and explain it. But I feel that it's essential to hear the words of the Rambam himself before I give the explanation to paraphrase it. And then we mentioned before that the idea of the knowledge of good and evil, and that comes into the picture right now, that prior to the sin, it would seem that Adam did not have the knowledge of good and evil. And yet we've established the fact that he had intellect. So if he had intellect, why didn't he have knowledge of good and evil? Now let me read to you from the Rambam. He says that he proves that Adam had intellect prior to the sin. And through the intellect, man distinguishes between the true and the false. This faculty Adam possessed perfectly and completely. The right and the wrong are terms employed in the science of apparent truth or morals, and not in that of necessary truth. Now, for example, it's not correct to say, in reference to the proposition, the heavens are spherical, it is good. You wouldn't say that's good. Or to declare the assertion that the earth is flat to be bad. So we say of the one it is true, and of the other it is false. Similarly, our language expresses the idea of true and false by the terms MS and Sheker. Now, something which is morally right and morally wrong we call Tov or Ra. So now we have two sets of terms to apply to two different sets of ideas. Okay? If you're talking about abstract realities, you're not going to say about a scientific proposition, about the force of gravity, about Einstein's theory of relativity, you're not going to say that it's good. It would be inappropriate. You're not going to say that it's bad. The issue is it's true or it's false. Of course, with regard to a certain action, a certain behavior, if a person behaves in a certain way, if a person is greedy, if a person is overly indulgent, you're not going to say it's true. You're going to say it's good, or you're going to say it's bad. So you see, there's two different realms now. That's what he's talking about. Well, morals, ethics, good and bad. Knowledge of the external world, true or false. Now, thus it is the function of the intellect to discriminate between the true and the false. A distinction which is applicable to all objects of intellectual perception. When Adam was yet in a state of innocence, and you mentioned the state of innocence prior to sin, and was guided solely by reflection and reason, on account of which it is said, he quotes the Tehillim, the Psalms, thou hast made man just a little bit lower than the angels, he was not at all able to follow or to understand the principles of apparent truth, morality. So all these ideas of good and bad just didn't make any sense to him. The most manifest impropriety, namely, to appear in a state of nudity, was nothing unbecoming, according to his understanding. He could not comprehend why it should be so. After man's disobedience, however, when he began to give way to desires which had their source in his imagination, and to the gratification of his bodily appetite, as it is said, and the woman saw that the tree was good for food and delightful to the eyes, he was punished by the loss a part of that intellectual faculty which he had previously possessed. He therefore transgressed the command with which he had been charged on the score of his reason. And having obtained the knowledge of the apparent truth, he was wholly absorbed in the study of what is proper and what is improper. Then he fully understood the magnitude of the loss he had sustained, what he had forfeited, and in what situation he was thereby placed. Hence we read, and you shall be like Elohim, knowing good and evil, and not knowing or discerning the true and the false. So according to the Rambam, that's really a punishment. The fact that he now has to be engaged in a whole new area of knowledge, the knowledge of good and evil, is a tremendous downfall for him, because he really should have been involved in a different world, the knowledge of true and false. While in necessary truth, we can only apply the words true and false, and not good and evil. Further, observe the passage,
and the eyes of both were opened, and they knew they were naked. It is not said, and the eyes of both were opened, and they saw. For what the man had seen previously, and what he saw after the circumstance, was precisely the same. There had been no blindness, which was now removed, but he received a new faculty, whereby he found things wrong, which previously he had not regarded as wrong. Now let me try to make some sense out of this. I think we've got a certain flavor of what he's talking about, and see if we can understand it. The Rambam says that before he committed the sin, he was not involved in the world in what he calls morals and ethics. And of course the question arises, if he did not have a conscience, if he didn't have a superego, so how do you define him as man? How is he supposed to be able to control his instinctual side, to control his instinctual appetite? So, the answer is as follows. The Rambam refers to the instincts, the instinctual component of man, as being the Yetzirah, the evil inclination. Nothing evil about it, it's just that it draws him in a certain type of a direction which is contrary to his purpose. The instinctual side of man. But the rabbis say that a change occurred in the nature of the instinctual side of man. And this is the terminology that they use. That before the sin, he had an evil inclination. He had the instinctual drive, but it was Yetzirah Mitzchut. It was external. As a result of the sin, the force of his instinctual energy was increased, but increased in a way that now was Yetzirah Mitzchut. The Yetzirah became internalized. So I'd like to try and explain that. What is the difference between the Yetzirah and the Mitzchut, that it's an external desire, as opposed to an internal desire? Because this is the focus of everything that the Rambam is talking about. See, what was the nature of Adam in the Garden of Eden? Man was created for a certain purpose. What was the purpose that God created him for? It's very, very interesting, because at the end of this entire story, what I'd like to do is see if we can elucidate what's the purpose of man. Go back to the Garden of Eden, you see. What did God create him to do? Well, that was what he was created for. But that's something that you're right, it's correct. That was one of his responsibilities. But that was mainly to sustain himself. Even in the Garden of Eden, he had to do some work to sustain himself. But sustenance is only a means to an end. What was his purpose? What was the purpose? Okay, good point. That's true. But the fruitful and multiply is only to create other humans so that they can fulfill their purpose, so we still have to understand, well, what is the purpose of those humans who are created? Okay? To serve God. What? Now, how do you serve God? What did you say, Aileen? To get closer to God. Now, how do you get closer to God? How is he supposed to do it? Well, you mentioned it before.
To live
a life which is in the service of God, but what will be the primary activity? What is the essence of the service of God? To be involved in getting closer to God through the knowledge of God. That he was studying the creations of God. That's the whole idea of the naming of the animals. And that's what he says, that he was wholly engaged. He was wholly engaged in the study and the appreciation of God through the study of his creation. That's why the intellect was focused and was directed purely towards the knowledge of that which we would call the true and the false. That was his purpose, and all of the energy naturally flowed towards the desires. His basic desire was for the good. Now, you see, you have to understand, we are not in the same state as Adam. Because in that state, his natural inclination, his natural drive, the thing that he thirsted after was to gain knowledge. We don't have a thirst for knowledge in the way that he had a thirst for knowledge. And the inclination was Mitzchut, was external. The rabbis say that when he saw Eve, when Eve was around, so then that would stimulate. It required an external stimulus to get his energy out of the arena of the love of knowledge and into the instinctual, because the natural flow of the energy was towards the love of knowledge. And the essential was external. So you have two different kinds. You have to understand. There are two kinds of drive that you have. There are certain things which are an inherent makeup of your personality. Things that you need, that you, when you wake up in the morning, you think about, you're striving for. A businessman is thinking about his business, and an athlete is thinking about his events. That's the natural flow. But there are other things that you don't necessarily have a desire for, but if you're in a certain situation with friends, and somebody serves some wine, so you can drink wine. But it's not something which is necessarily internalized, you can think about all the time. That's an external type of thing. You see? Now, to understand Adam, you have to understand the state that we're in. Would you say that our... How are we? Would you say that our Yetzer Hara is external, or would you say that the Yetzer Hara is internal, as Mrs. Nim? It's internal. It's internal. You see, that's why it's so difficult raising children. That's why, let's take something like learning. It's so difficult to get kids to be motivated into learning. That's not what... They don't wake up in the morning, well, I can't wait to go and learn a piece of tomorrow or to learn history. You don't have that feeling. What he's looking forward to is playing ball, listening to music, dancing, having fun. That's where you're at. That's where you're at. But that's not just... Let's not just talk about our kids. Let's talk about ourselves. We're basically everybody the same way. But you'll notice that sometimes you can get somebody... If you get the kid or anybody involved in a problem, give them a problem on the computer. Any kind of a problem that he might be... Children, by the way, have a natural curiosity. Children have a natural curiosity. They ask a lot of questions at a certain age. And usually that curiosity lasts up until the time they go to school. That's when it's basically... that's what school's accomplished. Maybe I'll talk about that tomorrow a little bit. How school's destroyed the natural inclination towards, you know, learning and curiosity. Because learning has to be something which is pleasurable. But even there are times when you can get engrossed in an idea. You can attend a class and it's a fascinating subject, and you're totally engrossed. And when you have those moments, you know, you feel completely free, oblivious to everything around you, and you're totally focused on it. And then you may have a sense of tremendous enjoyment. Wow, I can't imagine how fast the time passed. But then what happens an hour later? As soon as you leave the class, so then you're thinking, I should be doing this all the time. This is wonderful. This is much more fun than the parties I've been going to, or whatever else I've been doing, which is, you know, not as much fun as I thought it would be, and so forth. But then immediately the energy goes back, and you get involved again and again, and the next morning you wake up and you don't feel like going to lunch. You never wake up feeling like you have to go. That's something you force yourself to do. Why? Because, see, this is the result of the sin. I'm just depicting that because in the state that Adam was in, he had a natural desire. Just as we have a natural desire for the instinctual, he had a natural desire for the intellectual, for the love of knowledge. All his energy gravitated towards that, and for him, the instinctual required a stimulus to get his energy out of that. That's why in that state, he was not involved in the study of good and evil, because he didn't have any. Good and evil is we need that. You see, because we're completely involved in the world of lust. All of our inclinations are involved in that area, so we have to draw guidelines. We have to be involved in, you can't, any appetite you're talking about, eating. Well, then you have to ask the question, how much? If you eat too little, well, that's no good. If you eat too much, that's indulgence. What exactly, where do you draw the line? And then the sexual, the aggressive. No aggressive, you can't get anywhere in the world. Too aggressive, you're harmful. So you're constantly involved in setting up codes of behavior. This much is right, this much is wrong, this is good, this is no good. He didn't have that problem. Because, look, if all people were like Rabbi Feinstein doesn't have to get raised, his mind is completely involved in the study, in the love of God through the study of God's creation. You could take an Einstein. He doesn't need a code of moral behavior because he naturally is drawn to the good. The extent to which he's involved in the instinctual is minimal. Basically, a person like that doesn't value the instinctual. It's just a means of sustenance. So this is what it means. Therefore, a being like that, the way God wanted man to be, was to be a creature who has an instinctual side, but he's able to dominate the instinctual side solely through the power of his reason and understanding, and without any need for a conscience whatsoever. That's the way that, and the way that God designed him, he was perfectly suited to do so, because he did have an instinctual side, but that was secondary. It was subsidiary. And the power of his mind, as long as he didn't sin, so that he was given one command. And that command was not to give in to the power of the imagination. That's why it's called the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. That man was given the choice to determine the kind of life that he would have. In order to sustain this kind of a life, he had to be able to overcome the desire. The tree was very desirous. It's very hard to... The tree doesn't tell you exactly what the fruit was. Nobody knows what the fruit was. But again, if you read the verses, unfortunately, the woman gets a rap over here, but the man is guilty as well. So the woman perceived that the tree was good for eating, and that it was a delight to the eyes, and that the tree was desirable as a means to wisdom. So there was this had a tremendous allure. Perhaps it was the fact that it was forbidden. And you have the discussion of the serpent. I'm not going into the serpent. But that curiosity, that emotional curiosity, the fantasy was overpowering. And there was this tremendous desire to get to know what it would be like to partake of that. And she took it. And she gave it to her husband with her, and they ate. Then the eyes of both of them were open, and they realized they were naked. Well, how did that happen? What happened? And why? Yes, Lenny?
How do we understand Hashem telling them originally, for on the day that you eat it, you shall surely die?
And that's a good question. That's a good question. And there's a number of interpretations. It's possible, the simplest interpretation is, not that they would die on that day, but that had they not sinned, had they lived in this perfect state, then death would not have been necessary. Because the reason that death is really necessary, as I've explained, what we call death is not really death. If a person lives a correct life, then it's physical, but the soul is separated, and the soul attains its ultimate state. And the truth, the ultimate level of knowledge. Now, prior to the sin, had man not sinned, he was created in such a perfected state that death would not have been necessary. So as a result of the sin, death now became necessary, because man is too involved in the instinctual to ever reach that ultimate state of perfection. Now, what happens over here is, let's follow the chain. They violate the command, and immediately they feel shame. What does that mean? That means immediately the faculty of superego is created. Why did it have to be created? Because this sin brought about, effectuated a change in the basic dynamics of the instinctual side of man. Before, there was the natural flow of the energy towards the love of knowledge and understanding. As a result of the sin, man became an instinctual creature. The natural flow of the energy was directed towards the instinctual. So once that happened, that the natural flow of the energy was directed towards the instinctual, so was he still a rational animal? Or was he just an animal who was a very dangerous animal? Because if a person is basically an animal, then he has, it's the intelligent animals that are much more dangerous. That's why man is the most dangerous creature. Because if the intelligence is under the control, at the service of the instinctual, then there's no stopping him. So the truth of the matter is that God created man for a purpose. And as we said yesterday, man exists only as long as he fulfills the purpose. Once he committed that sin, and he changed his nature, and he no longer suited the description, what should have happened to him at that point? What should God have done? What should have been the punishment? He should have killed him. He was guilty. He deserved to die because he was no longer the same creature. See, man is the only being who has the capacity to be disobedient, not to live in accordance with his objective, with his purpose. No other animal has the ability. So according to strict justice, see, the first chapter, the first account is strict justice. According to the principle of strict justice, he should have been destroyed because that's not the being that I intended. That's not what I wanted. Because I wanted a being who's going to live a life of intelligence and wisdom and pursue knowledge. But compassion enters into the picture. In order for man, if God had not intervened at this point, and man is just another animal who's different because he could use his mind to achieve his instinctual objectives, so then there's no purpose. He's just another animal. He's a destructive animal, and we see that in the world all around us today. That there's people who live purely according to their egotism or to their sadism, and they have no checks on their instincts, and they just use their intelligence to achieve their evil objectives, That's basically Hitler. That's basically evil. So in order for man to continue to exist, God had to create a new faculty. And this faculty was the superego, which the whole purpose of conscience, and we do not believe that let conscience be your guide. We believe let your wisdom be your guide. Chachma has to be your guide. But in order for man to live a life of chachma, the power of wisdom to control the instincts is not enough. God has to create a counterweight, a counterforce to the force of the instincts. The instincts now became too powerful. So God created a new force. And now what happens to man? Man is always in a state of conflict. In every area of your life. The reason why people cannot be happy... See, it's impossibility for people to be happy purely in a natural way. That was the philosophy, you know, the 60s. That is, just let men return to a natural... Remove restraints and you automatically be happy. It's impossible. Because everything that you're involved in always involves conflict. So if a person has a desire, he has temptation, but then he has the guilt and the shame, the regret. There's not one area of your life that's free of emotional conflict on the natural plane. And when that happens, you're in a state of conflict. And now you have to use your mind to resolve the conflict. The only way that man could continue to exist as a thinking being was if there'd be a force which would be counter and which would to the instinctual and which will create a conflict. And now the only way to resolve the conflict is intelligence has to be used not for the highest purpose of gaining of wisdom and knowledge, but purely in the realm of morals and ethics and drawing the guidelines and determining how far to go. So that's the idea of the punishment, that let's just recapitulate the basic questions that we raised at the beginning, and that is that the story of the Chet is really the story of the objective that God had in creating man, what the purpose is, that God created a being that was endowed with the Tzelem Elokim. The Tzelem Elokim, the divine, you see, the conscience is not part of the Tzelem Elokim. The essence of the Tzelem Elokim is the power of man to reason and to gain knowledge, and as a result of that, to achieve a certain relationship, an appreciation of God, of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And the ideal would be that the power of reason per se would be able to control the instinctual. And that's the highest level of existence. But as a result of the transgression, so man effectuated a change in his basic nature. And he caused the instinctual to be the dominant force, that the basic energy of man now goes towards the instinctual. So on the basis of this, let's see if we can resolve one of the questions that we raised. That this sin is recorded as part of the story of creation, and it's not recorded as part of the history of man. What's the reason for that? On the basis of the explanation that we've just given. Exactly. Because creation was not complete. There was an element of creation, the creation of conscience. Man was not complete in terms of creation. That's why this story, whose purpose is to give you an insight into the nature of man, is included in creation, because what you see from this is that man participates in his own creation. Man is the only being of all of the creatures that was involved, that played a role and participates. In a sense, he makes himself, he creates himself, he determines himself. And God responded in the creation, God responded to the manner in which he behaved. And he gave him a choice. That's the idea of choice. And the choice was, he had free will. He had free will, and that is that had he been able to control the desire, the fantasy, he had to live in a state of command. Because human existence is impossible unless man is in a state where he's adhering to a command of God. So he was given one command. The command was not to eat from the fruit of that one tree. And then everything else is available to you. But because the story is because he was overcome by the fantasies, the desires that stem from the fantasies, and he transgressed that commandment, this sin is different than any other sin. Because this sin effectuated a fundamental change in his whole structure. It was a structural change. As a result of that structural change, he no longer conformed to the definition of man. Because he's just another animal. And an animal with seichel, with wisdom, is the most dangerous animal. So, in the first account, the term, what term is being used? Elohim. Because that's strict justice. Strict justice means the ideal. When God relates to us in accordance with the ideal of how we ought to be, that's strict justice. But then there's another element which we call compassion. In the second, when God punished him, and when God gave him a conscience, and drove him out of the garden, that was compassion, because that enabled him to continue to exist. According to strict justice, that's it. He should have lost his existence, because he no longer conformed to his purpose. The element of compassion means when God is willing to make adjustments to conform to the problems that emerge as a result of our weaknesses. So God intervened in the standpoint of compassion to make the adjustments which were necessary. But now man is on a lower level. And that was the Rambam's answer to the questioner. It's not a reward. He's on a lower level. Because his real purpose is to be involved in the highest form of knowledge. The highest form of knowledge which leads a person to a certain closeness to God is the abstract. Truth. The world is true and false. And as we've said many times, through the study of the Torah, the abstract ideas of Torah, and through the study of nature, the Rambam says as well. That Judaism endorses the involvement in the study of nature. The wisdom of God is manifested in this creation. But now it's a struggle. You see, now we have to struggle. We're constantly in a state of conflict. We have to struggle against the other desires, the desires that take us away from that, which create illusions and fantasies. And a person is always involved in that struggle. And then that, of course, is a result of the punishment. But the truth of the matter is that we should recognize what our goal is. And the goal is to be involved in that struggle and to constantly raise ourselves higher and higher, because as a person is able to overcome the instinct and to cultivate a love of learning, so then the soul begins to go through a certain change. And the more a person immerses himself in the world of knowledge and learning and appreciates the enjoyment of learning, then the person begins to compare the enjoyment that they get from the world of learning and knowledge to the disappointment that they are going to feel in the world of the instinctual. And anybody who spends his life living an instinctual existence winds up in a state of tremendous depression, because it's a never-ending series of disappointments, illusions, chasing after fantasies. As Chazal says, Always kesef lo yisba kesef. A person that loves money will never be satisfied with money. Because the more you pursue, the more unsatisfying it is. And then you need more thrills and more thrills. If a person has the wisdom to recognize that in that arena that he's attracted to, the instinctual arena, does not have the capacity to provide a real satisfaction to man. It's just an illusion. And to redirect himself towards a recognition of the real good and the real enjoyment, which is to be involved in the world of true learning and true knowledge, then as he goes on that path, he's getting closer and closer to the Garden of Eden. That's the real state of perfection. When a person, and there are people, our great sages in every generation, were people essentially that they could never stop learning. Their love of learning was such that they gravitated towards that naturally. A person can reach that level. But that is the true level. That's the true level that everybody should strive for. Okay. And when I said before that Judaism does not believe in the idea of let conscience be your guide, I think now you'll understand. Because conscience, the fact that you feel something, interesting point over here. See, people will just go by their feelings. And they believe their feelings as though their feelings are... So when you have a desire for something and you feel that it's good, you go ahead and you do it because you trust your feelings. Then when you feel guilty about something, and guilt is a killer, parents suffer a lot from guilt. When a parent will punish a child, so then the child will complain or cry or whimper, And then the parent feels very, very guilty about it. So then, when you feel guilty about it, you immediately assume you're wrong. Alright? Now, what you learn from the story is... I'm sorry? No. Okay, so you got over that. But there is a tendency, though. There's no question that's something... You see, this story shows that you can't base your decisions on how you feel about something. The feelings are deceptive. And the truth of the matter is there are many occasions when you don't feel guilty about a decision, but it's wrong. And there are many occasions when you do feel guilty about a decision, it could be right. But when you're feeling very guilty about it, you then have to talk to someone. What I said before is true, that when you feel guilty about something, it really causes you to doubt. Maybe I did the wrong thing. Because you're feeling so terrible, you're feeling so guilty. Now, if you go and talk to someone who's objective, and the person will point out to you that you need the correction, then you'll feel relieved. But before you felt relieved, you felt guilty. And when you felt guilty, you feel like you were wrong. Now, in all of these cases, you're letting conscience be your guide. Now, conscience varies. It depends on what the idea is of convention. So, in one society, killing could be a wonderful thing. In another society, asceticism could be a wonderful thing. There's all different types of societies, there are all different kinds of conventions. What the Torah tells you is that you can't base your decision on any particular emotion, whether it comes from the instinct, or whether it comes from the so-called good inclination, whether it comes from the conscience. Just because it's your conscience doesn't mean it's true. The purpose of conscience was instituted for one thing, to let your mind work. If you didn't have conscience, you'd be overwhelmed by your instinct. There'd be no way you could control your instinct. So God created a counterforce. The purpose of the counterforce was not that you should live in accordance with the counterforce. The purpose is as the purpose was in the Garden of Eden, that man must live in accordance with his knowledge, in accordance with his understanding. When he's acting that way, he's living as a divinely created being, as a rational being. And of course, as we apply our knowledge to the study of the Torah, that's the revelation. That's why God gave us the Torah. If God gave us the Torah, to use our intelligence, to understand it, to use it, our minds. And many people can follow the Torah and just become... They're just using it to project their own emotions onto Torah, to gratify their emotions through Torah. That's not a proper observance of Torah. The proper observance of Torah, the real objective is, to the best of our ability, to use our intelligence. So not to be swept away by our religious fervor, by our religion. Just because an emotion is religious doesn't mean it's good. Doesn't mean it's true. It's just an emotion. And an intelligent person learns in his life to recognize the difference between how I feel about something. That's the sign of a really perfected individual. I feel very strongly about it, but I know it's just a feeling. I will not base my action on that. Okay, that's how I feel. That's how my conscience feels. But neither one makes it true. Now let the mind work. And when you engage in the process of thought, and you're able to arrive at an intelligent decision, and you can act that way, irrespective of your emotions, contrary to your emotions, because you're acting in accordance with knowledge, then you're acting as a divinely created being. Okay, thank you very much. That's yeah. And thanks for the applause. A question. It's so hot. Last night was very hot and tonight was very hot. Is that like part of the, it's part of this year. Hot. That's why, next week we're going to have it outdoors. Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, question. Murray.
Thank you. energy is directly flowing from the left, so how does that be better?
That's a good question. Yeah, it's a good question. Everybody asked that question. By the way, that's what this idea of Adam in the state of Gan Eden, the way we just depicted him before the sin, that he has this natural desire to do the good and to be involved in learning. The Ramban says that's what man will be like in Olam Haba. That's the Ramban's idea of Olam Haba. That man's nature, that's what he calls the circumcision of the heart. That the heart will be circumcised means the emotional disposition will be changed, so that man's natural energy will flow towards knowledge. That's the Ramban Nachmanides. That's his concept. Yes. That's a good question that's being raised. How could man sin? But you have to understand that even in the state that we talked about in Gan Eden, he had free will. Because he did have imagination. Since he had an instinctual side to him, he did have the power. As I said, it required an external stimulus. But the stimulus would produce within him certain emotional feelings, and he was supposed to then use his mind to decide whether he should gratify them or not. So the tree was a stimulus.
When he saw the tree, the first time,
First of all, let's face it. As soon as you're commanded that you can't have something, that creates a lot of curiosity. That's the way people work. As soon as it's the thing that you can't have, so then there's the curiosity factor. Then the tree itself, you see, the woman actually, as I said, the sin of the woman was a little bit different than the man. They both sinned. But it seems that what emerges from the story is that the sin of the woman was her inability to control the desire, the power of fantasy. The sin of the man was that he gave in to her and that he needed her approval. That was his sin. Because it says that she gave it to the man with her. But as soon as... I'm sorry? She didn't want to be alone. Yeah. She didn't want to be alone. So that's another thing you learn. It's a very important way to mention it. So it's another very, very important idea. Because we have this concept of achote umachti, that someone is a sinner and causes other people to sin. So you should know in general that whenever you sin, you're going to cause others to sin as well. Because you have to do it with friends and whoever it is, it's very difficult for people to stand alone, especially when they're sinning, because they feel isolated, so they need a companion. So usually when you sin, you try and get others to go along. Whenever you want to do something you know you shouldn't be doing, you have a friend that's there for you, and that's for that purpose. I'm sorry, I can't hear you. Yeah, well, her fear was, as Aileen says, that she would be left alone, that he'd be on a higher level and she'd be on a lower level, and then he would reject her. So she couldn't tolerate that idea, so she gave it to him. He accepted it, because it says, God says later on, because you listened to the voice of your wife. But the Torah doesn't say that she said anything. So what does it mean you listened to the voice of your wife? It was a silent communication. It meant that when she gave it to him, there was a message. And the message was, I'll be very upset if you don't eat me. I'll be very disappointed in you. So he gave in to that. He couldn't tolerate the idea that he would not get her approval. That was his thing. I'm sorry. Did you ever? If she didn't sin, yeah. That's the implication. That's the implication that he had a power and a weakness. She had a strength and a weakness. They both had strength. They both had weakness. It would seem from this story, I don't know how much you can generalize, and that's always a dangerous thing with these kinds of things, is that he had the ability to control the desire, that his desire for the tree was not that overpowering. Her desire was, she had more curiosity. That's what it would seem. But his weakness was in the area that he needed her approval, and that he couldn't function without it. That was his Achilles heel, so to speak. In fact, he puts the blame on the woman. When God confronts him, what does he say? The woman that you placed here with me, she gave me. So you see another thing from that as soon as you sin, your whole relationship to God suffers, because you can't even want to take the blame himself. So instead of appreciating the good, because the Torah depicts the creation of woman as being a great good, he was alone, he was lonely, so God created the woman, so that was a good. So now he turned it into a bad. It's your fault. He's blaming God. You placed the woman here with me. So he disparaged the woman. Of course, when he saw her, he was very excited. Bone, flesh of my flesh, bone of my bones. That then it was a good. But as soon as he sinned, he blamed it on her and became a bad. I'll get a question, right?
Yeah, like, why would he, if God wanted man to, the purpose of man to be closer to God?
Yeah.
And as you mentioned before, why would he even have this figure there to give you it? Is it a faith to man? Or that he is had as a question of.
Good point.
Man eating from the tree and then recovering, you know, having the ability, you know, like it's like if you have. If you don't have mitzvah to do, you're naked.
Well, your question is like this. Your question, I believe, is if God wanted man to be good, so why did he place the tree? If the tree wouldn't have been there,
then you don't have free will.
Exactly. Exactly. And many people ask this question. If God wants me to be good, so why did God give me all these instincts and desires that caused me to be bad? So the answer is it's not true that God wants you to be good. You have to reformulate it. God wants you to be the cause of your own goodness. If God wants to, he could have created you as an angel. If he would have created you without desires, then you'd just be involved in fishing the whole time. But that's not free will. It was God's will, God's wisdom dictated that man should have free will. Free will means you will always have the potential for sin. There's always going to be a tree. There's always going to be a temptation. That just comes with the scheme of things. Oh, yes. Question.
It's probably a silly question, but why did God need man?
Somebody said last week there's no such thing as a silly question. Was it Doug? I think Doug said that. Doug Taylor. Same idea. Go ahead.
Why did God need man?
Oh, that's a whole other subject. That's not a silly question at all. So, first I'll give you an assignment. You can read this book. But seriously, the Rambam takes it up. It's a very, very good question. But it's such a good question that I won't just give you a quick answer. It wouldn't do it justice. And that I will reserve as a special topic. Okay? So put that on the list, and I'll be happy to do that. I cannot give a kind of short answer. It's a very profound issue, which the great philosophy will take up. Yes?
If God knows,
yes. Well, you're asking another very good question, which is another key, and that's, is there a conflict in God's foreknowledge and man's free will?
Mm-hmm.
And the Rambam also takes up that question. That's also another key. I can't deal with that. So, let's keep coming back. That's the point. I don't answer all the questions in one day. Because if I did, then there'd be no point in coming back. Right? So I try and leave you with something to think about. Keep studying. Everybody says, what do you learn from this? Keep studying. Write down your questions, and we'll keep learning together, and everybody will grow, hopefully. And we'll go back to the Garden of Eden. Okay?
Next week is flood.
Okay.